We started with a proposition that if Jesus is the Son of God, then God exists. If God has a Son, then God must be there, okay? And so that's basically the proposition that we are trying to present and to prove in this series of studies. The question, of course, is whether or not Jesus really is God, whether or not he is truly the Son of God, and whether or not he is in some way God. And we noted that the New Testament considers this question directly in the Gospels, particularly in all of the New Testament, but particularly in the Gospels, and that they contain eyewitness testimony to this fact. The men who are the ones who are writing the New Testament to us, and particularly the Gospels, these men claim to have seen not just a man named Jesus, but the Son of God, Jesus the Son of God, God in the person of Jesus Christ. And if we're going to believe that God exists based on the Gospels and what they have to say, then we're going to have to be convinced, first and foremost, that the testimony of these men is historically reliable. That when we read the documents of the New Testament and we read about what Jesus did and what happened to him and what is at least claimed happened to him, is this historically accurate information? Is this information that is relating to us things that actually happened in time and space? And so we're going to have to come to the point where we have confidence in the historical trustworthiness of the testimony that is recorded in the New Testament. And so there's a question. The question then is there a way to test the historical reliability of the New Testament? Is there some way that we can examine these documents and come away from those documents with confidence that they absolutely do relate to us accurate historical events? And I would suggest to you that there is a way to do that. And the way we would do that is by using the same method that is used by historians to determine the historical reliability of any ancient document. There are many men in history that have, in times past, who have written about events that occurred in their day, things that have happened. And some have written histories about things that happened before them. And we have those ancient documents, some of those ancient documents preserved for us. And in fact, that's how we have come to know a lot of what we know about ancient history. How do we know about Alexander the Great? How do we know about Julius Caesar? How do we know about the Roman Empire? Well, because there were historians at that time that related or wrote down, made records of those historical events. And so when an ancient document, an ancient historical document is uncovered and it relates some events from history, how do historians take those documents and determine, is this really a historical account, or is this maybe just some sort of myth or some sort of legend, some sort of story that somebody told maybe in that historical setting? How do they determine that? And there are some tests that historians use to determine the historical reliability of any ancient document. Basically, there are three tests. There is the bibliographical test, which involves three parts. There is the internal test, and then there is the external test. And when you conduct or put any ancient document to these tests, depending on how well they pass the test, will then determine whether or not we can read this document and decide and come to away from it thinking that we're learning accurate information about things that actually happened in the past. The first of these three tests, the bibliographical test, is used essentially to determine, do we have an accurate copy of the original? If you're going to first of all look at a historical document and say, does this relate to us accurate information? The first thing that we have to determine is, what we're looking at is not the original autographed piece of paper that they wrote on. We're reading a copy of a copy, maybe in some cases a copy of the original, I don't know. But the point is, we're reading copies. We don't have the original pieces of paper upon which these historians wrote these various events. So do we have an accurate copy? Does this copy represent an accurate copy of what was originally written by the author? And so that particular test is one of the tests that is used. And when we conducted that test last night, all three parts of that test on the New Testament documents last night, We determined that the New Testament passes this test better than any other ancient historical document. There is more, we can have greater confidence in the accuracy of the copies of the New Testament, that we have an accurate representation of what the New Testament historians wrote. We have a confidence of that more than we can be confident of almost anything else. In fact, we can be so confident, the New Testament documents pass this test so well, that in fact, better than any other ancient historical document, so much so that if we discredit the New Testament for some reason on the basis that we say it doesn't pass this test very well, then what we have to do is we have to discredit everything we know from ancient history. Because the New Testament, as we saw last night, clearly passes all three parts of this test better than any other ancient historical document. And so what we now do tonight is we turn our attention to the second and third test, the internal test, and then the external test. And by the end of that, I think we will have a good, confident feeling, or we'll have a good idea of whether or not when we read the New Testament documents, are we reading something that's accurately relating history to us or not? So we turn our attention, first of all, then, to the internal test. And I would suggest to you that the purpose of this particular test is to try to locate any possible self-incrimination on the part of the original writer. So with an ancient document, first thing that we do with the internal test is we look at it, and is there anywhere in this document that the writer of these documents, do they incriminate themselves? Do they prove themselves to be at fault, mistaken, because they somehow contradict themselves? Or maybe they contradict other known facts from history. Are there times when the writer contradicts himself or other writers or known geographical or historical facts? Does he somehow incriminate himself by failing to pass that kind of a test? Now, there are two important facts, I think, that we have to remember when we consider applying this test to the New Testament documents. Because what I want you to understand about the New Testament documents is that there's something about them that is especially important to this particular idea of the internal test. Number one, the New Testament documents record primary or first-hand sources. In other words, what the New Testament purports or reports to claims to report are the testimony of those who were actual eyewitnesses of the events, or those who were given their information from those who were actual eyewitnesses to the events. And what I want you to understand is that the New Testament claims that that's what we're doing, is that we're actually telling you what we saw, or I'm telling you what this man that I interviewed saw. I'm telling you exactly what he said he saw. So these are firsthand sources that are being quoted with the New Testament. And I demonstrate that in a couple of passages of Scripture. For example, in 1 John chapter 1, beginning at verse 1, I think this is a text we read earlier. What was from the beginning, this is 1 John 1, beginning at verse 1, what was from the beginning, what we have heard, what we have seen with our eyes, what we have looked at and touched with our hands concerning the word of life, and the life was manifested, and we have seen and testified and proclaimed to you the eternal life which was with the Father and was manifested to us. What we have seen and heard, we proclaim to you also, so that you may have fellowship with us, and indeed our fellowship is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ. You see what John is saying here? John is saying that what we have seen, heard, and touched with our hands. That's what we're talking about. We're telling you about things that we saw with our own eyes, things that we heard with our own ears, things that we felt with our own hands. And in fact, in verse 1, there is another word that's used in that text. He says, what we have heard, what we have seen with our eyes, what we have looked at and touched. The word that is translated in the New American Standard Version, looked at, is a word, it's the word theao, or theaomai, excuse me, and it's a word that has to do with the idea of carefully considering something. It's almost a word that describes the idea of examining something. So John is not simply saying we we just kind of got a passing glance at these events. John is saying that we heard these things with our ears, we saw these things with our eyes, we touched them with our hands. In fact, we actually examined the things that we're testifying to you about. So John is claiming to be, he is claiming for himself and the apostles to be a firsthand, to have firsthand knowledge of those things based on the five senses, what we heard, see, hear, touch. And I will suggest later on in our week that they actually used the sense of taste, and all of those kinds of things are involved in their testimony with regard to their what they saw. Peter, the Apostle Peter, as he writes 2 Peter, and I would suggest to you that Peter is probably the one, very likely, the one who basically gave the information that he that is recorded in Mark. It's just he gave that information to Mark, and Mark is strongly influenced by Peter. But here's what Peter says in 1 Peter or 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse beginning at verse 6 at verse 16. He says, "For we did not follow cleverly devised tales when we made known to you the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but we were eyewitnesses of his majesty." Peter's saying that we are telling you something, we're telling you about things that we actually saw with our eyes. Luke talks about this in the opening part of his gospel. Luke, I don't know if you remember it or not, but Luke writes his gospel to a particular man who is a Gentile, a man by the name of Theophilus. There are some great and infamous important information that is recorded for us and that can be discovered with regard to Luke and the writing of his gospel. But here's what Luke says in that prologue, in the introduction of his gospel as he writes to Theophilus. He says, "Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile an account of the things accomplished among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and servants of the word, it seemed fitting to me as well, having investigated everything carefully from the beginning, to write it out to you in consecutive order, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the exact truth about the things that you have been taught." Notice that Luke says, "I have gone to the trouble of investigating these things carefully." Your older version may use the expression that he traced these things. The idea is that Luke here actually went and conducted investigation into the things that he writes about. He goes and talks to eyewitnesses of these events and talks about what he had learned when he went to talk to those eyewitnesses. There's a period of time with one of the we sections in the book of Acts, one of the times when Luke is involved in the events that are occurring in the book of Acts is when Paul is at Caesarea Philippi. He is there for 2 years as a prisoner. And Luke is with Paul during that period of time. And that would have been a wonderful time, and probably was the time, at which Luke went and actually spoke to eyewitnesses throughout Judea and Galilee and those areas, and talked to those who saw these things. So Luke says, "I investigated these things and I talked to eyewitnesses." By the way, one of the interesting things to notice about Luke is that Luke was a doctor. Colossians chapter 4 teaches us that he was the beloved physician. And Luke was a Greek doctor. We know from the information that not only was Luke a doctor, he was a Greek doctor, a Greek physician. Well, you understand, of course, that Greek medicine of the first century, though it was rather primitive compared to our standards today, Greek medicine was not shabby medicine. Greek medicine was the father of modern medicine. And Luke was one of those Greek doctors. Now what we have with Luke then is we actually have eyewitness testimony from a man of science. And he's saying, "I went around and I talked to eyewitnesses about these events. And I'm recording to you about these events." One of the real interesting things, this is a side note with regard to Luke, we noticed that Peter said in 2 Peter chapter 1 and verse 16 that we were eyewitnesses of these things. He uses the normal word for eyewitness that has to do with exactly, it means exactly what we mean when we say eyewitness. It's interesting that Luke doesn't use that normal word for eyewitness. Luke actually uses a different word. He uses the Greek word autoptes. Now, if you think about what Luke was, a physician, and you say the word autoptes a couple times in your mind, you might recognize that we get an English word from autoptes, the word autopsy. What is an autopsy? An autopsy is something where a doctor examines a body to try to determine the cause of death. And that's the word that Luke uses when he talks about eyewitnesses. He calls them and he describes this circumstance kind of like a doctor who is doing an autopsy. So we're talking about men who are carefully investigating the facts, who are eyewitnesses to these events. And so it's important to recognize that these are our firsthand accounts. And it's also very important to note, and I make this point very clearly with you, it's also very important to note that the New Testament then wasn't written by men several generations away from the original. In other words, we don't have somebody living in the second or third or fourth century saying, let me tell you about what happened way back in the first century. What we have is we have men who were actually living at the time of the events and are recording these events during their own lifetime. So they are written then by the men who actually experienced these things. They are the original eyewitnesses. And not only then are they written by these original eyewitnesses, these records are not only written at that time, but they are also distributed during the lifetime of the eyewitnesses, circulated during the lifetime of the eyewitnesses. That means, guys, that when Luke or Mark or John or Matthew or whatever, whoever wrote something that was historical in nature about events that occurred in the first century with regard to Jesus of Nazareth, for example, that these things were written about and circulated so that if there was someone who knew that these facts weren't true, maybe someone who was not favorable to Christianity, those people had the opportunity then to refute those facts because they were still alive. They could actually go and talk to the eyewitnesses to determine if that really happened or not. And that's very, very important. And what's so interesting is that we have nothing that has survived in secular history where someone came along and tried to deny the things that Jesus was have claimed to have done by these authors. Their facts are not denied by secular historians. That's very, very interesting. So first of all, we recognize, as we talk about this particular test, that we're looking at primary, firsthand eyewitness accounts of the events that occur. Second thing that's important when conducting this test with regard to the New Testament, and that is, I'm going the wrong way. The second point is that the burden of proving a contradiction exists, that falls on the critic or the one who is claiming that a contradiction is there. So we're looking at these accounts and we're trying to figure out, did these guys contradict themselves? Did they somehow contradict themselves or one another or some other historical event or some other geographical event? Did they somehow incriminate themselves by contradicting themselves? And I would suggest to you that that the burden of proving that they contradicted themselves falls upon the person who claims that there's a contradiction. You see, it is one thing to charge the New Testament writers with having contradicted themselves. It is altogether another thing to make that charge stick. You know, they charged Jesus with all sorts of things that he simply wasn't guilty of, as far as I'm concerned. As far as I know the information about it. And the point is, you can make a charge against somebody. You can charge the New Testament documents as being contradictory. But now prove it. Prove it. That's what has to be done. Now, with the varied backgrounds of the different New Testament writers, different men from different walks of life, different time, different ages, their physical ages were different, you would probably expect to find at least some contradictions. But the amazing thing is that when we examine the New Testament records, We cannot ever find any contradiction that one of the writers makes. No writer contradicts himself or some other writer of the New Testament records, or do they never contradict any other known facts of history. In fact, what is so interesting is that when you relate the New Testament accounts to secular history, they always match up. They're always consistent. And so when we examine the New Testament to try to find examples of self-incrimination, we cannot find any. Now, I would suggest to you that, of course, the effort has been made to do that. It's been made to do that. Efforts have been made for years trying to find contradictions with the New Testament. I remember I told you last night about the time that I first heard this kind of a presentation made was by Ken Chumley down in Champaign when he debated Madeleine O'Hare's right-hand man. And what's interesting is when we went to the university there for this debate, they had a table there in which Ken Chumley had some tracts, which he was using to distribute to people, hopefully encouraging them to be believers. Well, the atheists had their table of tracts too, and I picked up a bunch of them. And there was one tract that was entitled Contradictions of the Bible. And one of the examples that they used of a contradiction of the Bible is they pointed to an Old Testament text where God ordered Israelites to circumcise their sons on the eighth day. And then they said the New Testament, the book of Galatians, which says that circumcision is nothing, is not important. Now they say that there, you see, we have a contradiction. Part of the Bible says you got to circumcise your sons. Another part of the Bible says you don't have to circumcise your son. It's not important to circumcise your son. See, that's a contradiction. No, that's not a contradiction. You don't know what you're talking about. That's the problem. You understand that, yes, under the old covenant, circumcision was necessary and was binding on the Israelite nation. But under the New Testament covenant, circumcision was no longer. There was a change of covenants. And that's why there's no contradiction at all. One of the most famous contradictions that is very often looked at in the New Testament is the comparison in the book of Acts that Luke gives of two accounts. There are actually three accounts in the book of Acts of Saul's conversion. And two of those accounts, on the surface, especially reading an older translation, seem to contradict themselves. In Acts the 9th chapter and in verse 7, we're told that the men who were with Saul of Tarsus, as he was on the road to Damascus and he saw the light and he heard the voice speak to heaven, Saul, from heaven, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? In Acts the 9th chapter, when Saul tells that, when that story is told the first time, the text says that the men who were with Saul, that they heard the voice. That they heard the voice. Later in the 22nd chapter, and in verse 9, when the story is being told a second time, this time by the Apostle Paul himself, as he defends himself to the Jews, he says that the men with him did not hear the voice. Contradiction. Luke has actually contradicted himself. In one instance, it says that the men heard the voice. In the other text, it says that they didn't hear the voice. The problem is that if anybody had taken the time to consult a standard Greek grammar, they would recognize that there are two different things being talked about there. We use the word, we have the same problem in English. We use the word hear sometimes to mean I hear the sound of something. And sometimes we use the word hear to mean I hear so clearly that I understand. So somebody might say something to us. It happens around our house quite often because I seem to be going deaf in my old age. Candy will say something to me and I'll say, what did you say? I didn't hear you. Well, I did hear her. I heard the sound of her voice. But when I said I didn't hear you, I meant by that I didn't hear you in the sense that I didn't understand you. And that's all that's happening in these texts. And grammatically, it's demonstrable that what's happening in the case when Paul says that they heard the voice, he's simply saying that they heard the sound of it. But later on, when it says they did not hear the voice, it's saying that they did not understand the voice. And in fact, that is exactly the way it's translated in the New American Standard Bible. In the first instance, they were hearing the voice. In the second instance, it says they did not understand the voice. Okay? The same kind of way that we would use. So what we're saying is, and this, by the way, has been one of the great contradictions of the Bible. It's not a contradiction at all. So the point is, it's easy to charge the New Testament with contradictions. It's another thing to make those accusations stick. And what I'm trying to suggest to you is that I would give you an example of an actual contradiction where the New Testament writers contradict themselves and therefore incriminate themselves as being not accurate historians. I'd give you an example if I knew of one that existed, but there are none that I know of, so I can't give you an example. I can give you an example, as I've done, of some alleged contradictions, but I demonstrate to you that every time those are carefully examined, it is clear that there is no contradiction whatsoever. And so the New Testament certainly passes the internal test. The New Testament writers are consistently accurate. There is nowhere that they are guilty of self-incrimination. You find no examples of that in the New Testament whatsoever. So now we've got the New Testament having passed part one and part two, or test one and test two, of what historians do when they're trying to determine the historical trustworthiness of Scripture. So all we've got to do now is go to the third test and see if the New Testament passes the third test. And the third test is called the external test. And the purpose of this test, the purpose of the external test, is to consider whether or not there is any other independent historical confirmation or corroboration of the information that is in the New Testament. Are there independent historical writings outside of the New Testament that confirm or corroborate the testimony that is given in the New Testament? And so we're looking to secular writers outside of the New Testament who were not Christians, maybe even enemies of the cause of Christ, and yet what they say actually corroborates, actually confirms the information. Is there any of that? Well, there are at least 18 secular non-Christian historians who refer to Jesus and various facts concerning his life and his teaching. Men like Gaius Suetonius Tranquillius, Pliny the Younger, Cornelius Tacitus, Flavius Josephus, and we referenced Cornelius Tacitus and Flavius Josephus last night. All of these historians lived when the New Testament writers lived and wrote. And all of these men write specifically at some point in their writings about Jesus Christ. None of these writers are Christians. Some of them were indifferent to the religion of Christ. Some of them were out and out enemies of the cross of Christ. So let me give you a couple of examples of some of the things that these extra-biblical, these outside of the Bible, these secular historians said as they're talking about whatever it is they're talking about, and they happen to mention something about Jesus. First of all, I talked to you about Pliny the Younger. Pliny the Younger was the governor of Bithynia, and he carried on a correspondence with his friend who was Emperor Trajan. And what his correspondence is preserved for us, and here's one of the things that he talks about as he tries, as a governor in Bithynia, to discipline, to control Christianity in his area. He says, "I have asked them if they are Christians." Brings these people before him that are accused of being Christians. He says, "I bring them before you, I ask them if they are Christians. And if they admit it, I repeat the question a second and a third time, warning of the punishment that awaits them. If they persist, I order them to be led away for execution. They also declare that the sum total of their guilt or error amounted to no more than this. They had met regularly before dawn on a fixed day to chant verses alternately amongst themselves in honor of Christ as if to a god, and to also bind themselves by oath, not for criminal purposes, but to abstain from theft, robbery, and adultery." Here's a guy talking about what I did to those who were followers of Christ, the ones who worshiped Christ as God. Reference to outside the New Testament, to the way Christians were treated. We talked about Cornelius Tacitus last night. And he has a very interesting thing where he talks about Nero, who persecuted Christians to divert suspicion from himself for a fire that burned the city of Rome in AD 64. Emperor Nero had wanted to rebuild the city of Rome, couldn't get the Senate to go along with it and to help fund it. And so while he's on vacation at Actium, suddenly the city just mysteriously catches on fire. And of course, everybody immediately suspects that Nero, of course, he's out of town, so how could I have had anything to do with it? Everybody suspects Nero of being the one who set the fire. So what does he do? He's got to find some sort of scapegoat. So what he does is he takes it out on the Christians. He blames it on the Christians. And Tacitus is telling us about that. He says, Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class for their abominations called Christians by the populace. Christus, which is a form of the word for Christ, a Christus from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate, and a most mischievous superstition, thus checked for a moment, again broke out not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but even in Rome. Do you see what this guy says? This guy confirms that the founder of this movement was some guy named Christ, Christus, who was actually suffered the extreme penalty. Let me tell you what the Romans meant by the extreme penalty. That was code for crucifixion. I mean, that's what the extreme penalty was. And who did he suffer it by the hands of? It was during the reign of Tiberius, by one of the procurators of Judea, a man named Pontius Pilate. Jesus was crucified during the reign of Tiberius by Pontius Pilate, folks. He's confirming the information that we read about in our New Testament. All of that information, the fact that Tiberius was the king during, or the emperor during the days of Jesus, the fact that he was crucified, by a Roman procurator or governor named Pontius Pilate, all that information is in the New Testament. And we've got this extra biblical account referencing that same kind of information. That's very important. I'm going to make a point about this in just a moment. We talk about Flavius Josephus. We talked about his writings, the Jewish Wars. He also wrote another work called the Antiquities. And Antiquities is basically the story of the Jewish nation. He goes all the way back to the beginning of time and tells their story all the way up through the time that he is still alive. And so toward the end of this book, he has a lot of things to say in that have to do with the first century. And so that's when he lived. Well, Flavius Josephus tells about how Ananias, a Jewish high priest, took advantage of the death of Festus. And by the way, Festus is mentioned in the New Testament. He takes advantage, and I don't have that part of the quote up here, I don't know why. He takes advantage during the death of Festus to kill James, the brother of Jesus, who was called the Christ. Well, you know, Jesus had a brother named James. Writes the book of James in the New Testament. Okay? And we're told that Ananias kills him. So here he's referencing James, the brother of Jesus, relating to Jesus. There's also something called, in Josephus' writings, called the the Testimonium Flavinium. It's a famous quotation from Josephus. And here's what he says. It's kind of a controversial passage, but it's highly significant because of some of the things that are said in it. And I recognize that there may be some of these things that kind of have been messed with, but ultimately this is an accurate representation of what he said. He said, now there was about this time Jesus, a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man, for he was a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of such men as received the truth with pleasure. He drew over to him both many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles. He was the Christ, or at least he was called the Christ. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men amongst us, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at first did not forsake him, for he appeared to them alive again the third day, at least it was reported, as the divine prophets had foretold these, and 10,000 other wonderful things concerning him, and the tribe of Christians so named from him are not extinct to this day. Now, I recognize that this is one of those controversial quotations from Josephus, but there are parts of this that are not questioned at all by historians. The fact that it was Jesus, that he was crucified by Pontius Pilate. And here's the thing that I think has got to be answered with regard to these matters. You understand that crucifixion, we'll talk a little bit about this tomorrow night, that crucifixion was the worst form of execution that was reserved only for the vilest of criminals. It was such an awful form of execution that it was actually illegal to execute a Roman by means of crucifixion. It was an extremely shameful form of execution. It was intended to be a shameful form of execution. It was intended to humiliate and make an object lesson of whomever was the victim, whomever was the one being executed. How do we explain such a powerful movement that grows and that continues to this very day, all of us in this building being part of this movement? How do you explain that kind of movement coming from someone who experienced such an ignominious, such a shameful form of execution? Had he been executed in some noble way through the killing of a sword with a sword or something like that? Yes, we might say. But someone who was crucified? No one in the first century would have followed someone who was crucified and stayed dead. Something was different about this guy. And we'll talk a little bit about that later. But what I'm saying to you is that these are indisputable facts. These are facts that are stated to us, told to us by men who were either antagonistic or at least indifferent toward Christianity. And they're confirming these kind of events that we read about in the New Testament. We could probably turn to others. The Jewish Talmud, let me just share with you some things about the Jewish Talmud, for example. I don't know if you know what the Jewish Talmud is, but it's if you read in the New Testament about the tradition of the elders, we read about, you know, the tradition of the elders, the Jews, as they were always upholding the tradition of the elders in their discussions with Jesus of Nazareth, according to the New Testament. The tradition of the elders was basically an oral commentary and elaboration on the Old Testament that was collected before and after AD 70. So even as they were defending the tradition of the elders, that tradition was actually continuing to be formulated because the rabbis were making commentary or giving commentary on the Old Testament. That commentary was ultimately collected and actually put down in written form around 200 AD in something called the Mishnah. So the Mishnah is basically a written commentary of the Old Testament by the Jewish rabbis. This Mishnah was also orally commented on, and these comments were then written down in what is called the Gemara. So the Mishnah is a written commentary, a written form of the oral commentary of the Old Testament. So it's a written commentary of the Old Testament. And the Gemara is a commentary of that commentary. Okay? It is the Mishnah and the Gemara that are put together, and they form what you and I have probably heard of when we hear about the Jewish Talmud. Okay? That's basically the Jewish, their proper understanding of the Old Testament and how it's supposed to be run and what you're supposed to do with regard to the Old Testament scriptures. I want you to know that the Talmud actually mentions Jesus of Nazareth on more than one occasion. And what is so interesting about it is that it never indicates that he is the true Messiah. It always designates him as a false Messiah who worked magic and sorcery. Now listen, what that says is that they didn't accept him as the Messiah, obviously, but they did not deny his miracles. They only tried to discredit them and cloak them under the guise of something that was sorcery or magic. And remember from the New Testament documents, what did they try to say Jesus, where he got his power from? They said, well, you get your power from Beelzebul, devil. And what I'm saying to you is that the Talmud is basically confirming that position that the New Testament takes with regard to Jesus doing miracles and maybe getting his power from the devil. It confirms that for us. Certainly doesn't deny his miracles. It just tries to reinterpret them. The point is that even without the Gospels, if we never read a copy of the New Testament without the Gospels, we'd still know a whole lot of historical truth about a man named Jesus of Nazareth. There's a guy by the name of Edwin Yamaguchi, who is one of the premier scholars in the last century of the New Testament in 1900s. Here's what he said we would know without even considering the gospel accounts. We would know that first, Jesus was a Jewish teacher. Second, we would know that many people believed that he performed healings and exorcisms. Third, some people believed he was the Messiah. Fourth, he was rejected by the Jewish leaders. Fifth, he was crucified under Pontius Pilate in the reign of Tiberius. Sixth, despite his shameful death, his followers, who believed he was still alive, spread beyond Palestine so that there were multitudes of them in Rome by AD 64. That's why Nero was able to blame the Christians. And seventh, all kinds of people from cities and countryside, men and women, slave and free people, worshiped him as God. We'd know that about Jesus without even opening a New Testament. We learn all of that from extra-biblical sources, from sources outside of the New Testament. So, does the New Testament pass the third and final test? I would suggest to you that it most certainly does. There is this kind of historical corroboration of the New Testament, maybe a lot more than we think outside of the Bible. And what's even interesting, we haven't even begun to talk about the archaeological information. And one of the interesting things is that many archaeologists have studied archaeology, have dug around Palestine and all that for the express purpose of trying to disprove the Bible. And every time they do that and they find something, they end up finding something that actually confirms the biblical account. Never have they found anything in archaeology that disproved things that are written in the gospel accounts of Jesus' life. So again, with this third and final test, the New Testament passes the test easily. It passes it as easily as any other ancient historical document. And so based on the normal test used to determine the historical accuracy of all ancient documents, there can be no doubt that the New Testament is historically accurate. I don't care what the History Channel says. When the History Channel is fair with the facts, they come to the same conclusion, and that is that the New Testament does relate accurate history.